Sri Chaitanya Manubhistam Sapitam Dena Bhutale Sayam Pagaramayam Dadati Sarpadantikam. Vansakapaturubhyascha Krivasindhubhaibhascha Paditanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah. Just as the Lord had told Kodama Muni after his many years of austere meditation and yoga practice, that the Lord would appear as his son, and he did appear as his son named Kapila Dev. So this was predicted by the Lord. The Lord had said it, that he would do this. And specifically, Krishna will tell, a little later on, he will tell Kardama Muni that I keep my word to my devotees. I promised you that I would appear as your son, I would come as your son, and now I have come. So when it was understood by Lord Brahma, who more or less knows everything within the material world and so much spiritual knowledge, when it was understood by Lord Brahma that Krishna himself had appeared within this world, he recognized the symptoms and he understood it. He came with all his sons, the great sages, the nine great sages, and also with Narada Muni and the four Kumaras. And in text 12, Lord Brahma says to Kardama Muni, because Kardama Muni took the instructions of his father, Lord Brahma, who was also his spiritual master, he took them very seriously, because Brahma wanted the world. His mission was to populate the universe, the world, so that the world can go on. He's the creator under Krishna's direction. So he was looking for help in doing this, and Kodama Muni, his son, agreed to help. And for that reason, Kodama had performed austerities and penances, and he had received the benediction of even seeing the Lord, and the Lord presented him with Vibhuti as his wife. So Brahma said to Kodama, "My dear Kodama, since you have completely accepted my instructions without duplicity, showing them proper respect, you have worshipped me properly. Whatever instructions you took from me, you have carried out, and thereby you have honored me." So Prabhupada, in his purport, explains such an important point, the point of how one must follow the instructions of one's spiritual master very, very carefully. One must honor the fact that one has a spiritual master. How? Prabhupada explains in the last line of the purport. To honor the spiritual master means to carry out his instructions word by word. Because by the grace of the spiritual master, one's spiritual master, one gets transcendental knowledge that one is unable to get from any other source. Because if we don't, transcendental knowledge means knowledge coming down from superior sources, realized sources. And in the material world, no one gets their knowledge in that way. Rather, people get their knowledge through their own powers, through their own intelligence and scientific investigation, etc. But that type of intelligence is insufficient to get knowledge beyond the material world. So to get knowledge out of the material world that is beyond our power to understand from within the material world, the source of that knowledge has to be out of the material world. And that is called, Krishna is the original source of knowledge, and the knowledge from Krishna comes to us through the chain of the cyclic succession, through this, the Guru Parampara, through the succession of teachers, one after another. So Brahma had given knowledge to Kodama and orders as well, and the orders were followed very carefully by Kodama Muni, quite respectfully. And therefore, look at the result that Kodama had received. What was the result? He had achieved that the Lord himself had come as his son, because he was such a strict follower. So Krishna himself came as his son, which is quite extraordinary. In the next verse, the same point is continued, how one must become a good follower. Sons ought to render service to their father. This is so far different from contemporary civilization. Just the opposite is there. Practically the sons are taught not to listen to anyone, that you're independent, and one should act for one's own self-interest. And this is very much due to the current emphasis on, or the acceptance of, this evolutionary theory, because if one accepts evolution, that means that one is more advanced than one's forefathers. So if one is more advanced than one's forefathers, if one listens to one's forefathers, they'll get in the way of the further advancement, because their knowledge is quite antiquated. It's old-fashioned. So onward and better, the pinnacle of evolutionary advancement, me, knowing more than everyone else. So the so different. Well, in this type of a culture, the wisdom of the ancients is preserved by a degree of submissiveness and accepting the authority of those seniors who have heard this from their seniors, who have heard this from their seniors. This is actually culture. The Krishna consciousness movement in that sense is very much in line with this. And it is an old man's movement. In what sense? That the wisdom of the elderly, of the seniors, are very much respected, is very much respected, because they have knowledge of what's going to happen in life. They know, the elderly people in society, they know that we're going to die. They know that we're going to get diseased in old age. The youth, somehow or another, when you are 16, 17, 18, 19, you don't know. You think you're never going to die. You think you're never going to get old. You think that the body is going to stay young and healthy forever. Nothing is going to happen to you. There's an imaginary sort of script that one has in one's mind of how life is going to work out so smoothly and wonderfully. Of course, it is only imaginary. It never happens like that. But the youth lives in that type of a delusion very often, thinking their body will remain strong, and if not, they will take this this new scientific drug or this new age twist on life or whatever, or do this or do that, and still, but you know, when you get old, you realize, wait, I never thought this was going to happen. I never expected that I would actually not have energy anymore, and that my knees would hurt and my back would hurt. It's inevitable. Eyes weaken, ears weaken, teeth fall out. The whole thing, and it's going to happen to everyone. When Prabhupada was very, very old, he saw one of his young disciples looking at him in a particular way, and Prabhupada understood what he was thinking. Because when you see old people, very old people, there's a tendency to be a little repulsed. So Prabhupada looked at him and said, "Don't think that this will not happen to you." So Krishna consciousness is an old man's religion in the sense that it teaches us how to live our life when we're young, with knowledge of what's going to happen to us when we're elderly and old and senior. Not living our life one way and then getting surprised, "Oh, I never expected this." No, living our life in such a way to take advantage of the inevitable what was that phrase that we heard today? To take the, to somehow make the inevitable a virtue. Turn something that is unnecessary, inevitably unfortunate, somehow turn that into a virtue. And because the devotees of the Lord live their lives, even in their youths, with this knowledge, yes, it is going to happen to me. By the time they are old, they are very, very wealthy, not with ephemeral, temporary, transitory wealth that like sand will sift through our fingers and actually have no taste or value when we're old. But actually, it will be the most prized possession when we're older. If we cultivate it in our youth, we'll have very, very valuable jewels of knowledge when we're older. And even death itself and old age and death, which are the worst things for a materialistic person who's based his life on that tendency and ability to enjoy, and gradually he sees his, that capacity ebbing away, and spends more and more money and time trying to save his strength. But ultimately he's going to lose this battle. But a Krishna conscious person does not undergo that type of anxiety. And even when death comes, he's practiced in his life to hold on tightly to the lotus feet of Krishna, because he has known all along that this is going to happen. So he's practiced through the good times and the bad, holding on to Krishna, taking shelter of Krishna, Krishna becoming his shelter. So therefore he's not surprised. Nothing in life can surprise him in that sense, because he knows he's in Krishna's hands. So in culture, in the Vedic culture, sons, Brahma explains, ought to render service to their father exactly to this extent. One should obey the commands of his father or spiritual master with due deference, saying, yes, sir. And the fathers, gives, and the mothers, of course, too, such a great responsibility is upon their shoulders to be, to give knowledge, not you must obey me and then go to the refrigerator and get me some beer. And, you know, go to buy me the cigarettes and do this and this and that, and let's go to hell together. No, not like that. But the father has to have the wisdom. And then the son should follow. Prabhupada's purport. Two words in this verse are very important. One word is pitri, and the other word is guru. The son or disciple should accept the words of his spiritual master and father without hesitation. Whatever the father and the spiritual master order should be taken without argument. Yes. There should be no instance in which the disciple or the son says, this is not correct, I cannot carry it out. When he says that, he has fallen. So very, very strict. A little later on in the purport, Prabhupada says, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has stated that the order of the spiritual master is the life and soul of the disciples. As a man cannot separate his life from his body, a disciple cannot separate the order of the spiritual master from his life. If a disciple follows the instructions of the spiritual master in that way, he is sure to become perfect. This is confirmed in the Upanishads. This is from Svatasvatara Upanishad. The import of Vedic instruction is revealed automatically only to one who has implicit faith in the Supreme Personality of Godhead and in his spiritual master. One may be materially considered an illiterate man, but if he has faith in the spiritual master as well as in the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then the meaning of scriptural revelation is immediately manifest before him. So how important this is, this type of faithful obedience, that regardless of one's education, even to the extent if one has no capacity to read anything, because usually We would think that someone who has no capacity to read has no capacity to be educated, to learn anything, to know anything. And knowledge is our wealth in that sense. It is our strength. But if one has unflinching faith in the spiritual master and Krishna, then all the imports, all the conclusions of the Vedic scriptures are revealed to him by Krishna from within. Yasya devi parabhakti yata devi tata guru. So, in this way, Brahma praised Kardama Muni's strict adherence to his orders. And then, because Kardama Muni, before having Kapila Muni as their child, they had 9 beautiful daughters. And Lord Brahma had a plan for those daughters. So what did he want? He said that they should be married to the great sages. And by that, the marriage to the sages, who Brahma had come with the sages, who were also his sons, by their marriage to the sages, the 9 sages, because there were 9 daughters and he came with 9 sages, that the universal population would increase. For Prabhupada, in his purport to 15, he makes some, because the Bhagavatam is written on different levels, so there's an ultimate level, an ultimate spiritual level, which sometimes even criticizes marriage and becoming entangled in material life at all. But at other times, explains a very practical level, because when the material is acted on properly, it can support the spiritual. So when we look at the spiritual in and of itself, it has no need for any material support. It is that strong. If one can just fully take shelter of the spiritual. But in case one cannot do that, and that is the case in most cases, that one can't do that, one needs a proper material situation in order to spiritually grow. So when looking at it from one perspective, from the perspective of the ultimate perspective, that only one needs spiritual life and nothing else, if one is that strong, then sometimes material life is condemned. But at other times, material life lived properly in support of the spiritual is very much glorified. So here, Prabhupada gives an explanation about marriage and the proper way to be married and the proper way to make the marriage match. So here is Prabhupada's purport on that. We'll read about 2/3 of the purport. The 9 principles, rishis or sages, are Maricha, Triangira, Pulastya, Pulaha, Kratu, Bhrigu, Vishishta, and Artava. All these rishis are most important, and Brahma desired that the 9 daughters already born of Kardama Muni be handed over to them. Here 2 words are used very significantly, Yata Shilam and Yata Ruchi. The daughters should be handed over to the respective rishis, not blindly, but according to the combination of character and taste. So there should be a matching of the character or the ideals, that which the partners marry, that which they hold dear, or character, the values that they hold. And on the other hand, there should be taste, that which attracts both of them. Because if one likes one thing and the other one likes exactly the opposite, if one has very high character or one has a low character, then there's going to be friction due to the different character and taste. So it should be the husband and wife, the boy and the girl, they should be matched to be husband and wife according to, they should have a similar character, similar ideals and values, similar ethics, and similar taste. They like the same kind of things. That is the art of combining a man and a woman. Man and woman, should not be united simply on the consideration of sex life. There are many other considerations, especially character and taste. Prabhupada is making this point strongly because nowadays, when people get married, it is just a matter of sexual attraction. And when that is diminished, then what happens? Then there's no reason to be married anymore, whether we have children, whether we don't have children. Suit, take them to court, divorce. Soon as there's more attraction to another person, divorce. So this marriage based on mutual physical attraction, that's another old man's wisdom. Because all the people know that familiarity brings contempt, and physical attraction must wane. It will wane, it must wane. It must disappear. It must, it will. There's no avoiding it. But the character, values, respect for the person's character and values, and having similar tastes, that can endure. And of course, it is ultimately marriage is held together by duty. So if the taste and character differ between the man and women, their combination will be unhappy. So if it's just on the physical attraction, it is doomed. Even about 40 years ago, in Indian marriages, the taste and character of the boy and girl were first of all matched, and then they were allowed to marry. This was done under the direction of the respective parents. Why did the parents get involved in this? Because the children, the boys and the girls, because they're young, they will be dominated by just the physical attraction. So the parents supervise this, so something whimsical isn't put together and then whimsically broken apart. The parents used to astrologically determine the character and tastes of the boy and girl, and when they corresponded, the match was selected. This girl and this boy are just suitable and they should be married. Other considerations were less important. The same system was also advised in the beginning of the creation by Brahma. Your daughters should be handed over to the rishis according to taste and character. According to astrological calculation, a person is classified according to whether he belongs to the godly or demoniac quality. And that way the spouse was selected. So in Vedic astrology called Jyotish, there are three gana, or categories. One is called Deva Gana, which means very godly. And then another is called Manushya Gana, or human-like. And the other is called Rakshasya Gana, or demonic. So in the case of marriages, you have to get married for it to work out. You have to get married in the same gana, in the same group. So if you have a demonic mentality, and it doesn't mean everyone exactly who was born with that gana has, but there's some tendencies that are indicated. So if you have that, for a happy marriage, you have to marry a person, a partner in that same group. So the people, the beer drinkers should marry beer drinkers, and the people, this is the way it has to work. You have to marry a person of the similar mentality if the marriage is going to work out. So Prabhupada explains, a girl of a godly quality should be handed over to a boy of a godly quality. That's Devagana. A girl of a demonic quality should be handed over to a boy of demonic quality. It sounds funny when you read it in English, but this is actually an astrological grouping. Then they will be happy. But if the girl is demonic and the boy is godly, you can imagine, then the combination is incompatible. Can I have some milk tonight? No, you have to drink beer. But I want milk. Drink your beer. Can I have some beer tonight? Drink your milk. So it doesn't work out. At the present moment, because boys and girls are not married according to quality and character, most marriages are unhappy. And there is divorce. So what's the divorce statistic nowadays? 50%, 60% in the West. Anyway, it's very high, very high. Horribly high. And then when your parents get divorced, the children suffer so much, and they have to read so many books on how to be happily married and things like that. But you don't learn these things from books or courses or seminars. How does one learn these things? Just by being in a family and watching happily married parents. And it's so rare nowadays that that exists in the West. Okay. So Brahma told Kardama Muni his desire about his daughters. Now he's going to continue to a different subject. He's going to speak about his son, Kapila Muni. O Kardama, I know that the original Supreme Personality of Godhead has now appeared as an incarnation by his internal energy. That means that when he comes by his own power, when we come to this world, we don't come by our own power. We don't choose what body we're going to be in, what family we're born in, what color our hair and eyes and our shoe size. We don't choose these things. We don't choose how our intelligence is, how our athletic ability is, how our beauty is. We don't choose these things. We are forced. The soul, according to the laws of material nature, is forced into a particular body according to his own karma, what he has done in previous lives. He's under superior control. Just that fact that none of us choose our body or the family or even the country we're born into. We didn't choose this. So that proves that we are not independent. But when Krishna comes, he is completely independent. He chooses exactly when he's going to be born, where he's going to be born, what his form will be, how much of his opulence he's going to display. He chooses his parents like that. So this is, he's incarnated by his internal or own energy, not forced. He is the bestower of all desires by the living entities. So this is another, Brahma is saying some of the characteristics of the Lord, that it is Krishna who bestows, who completes our desires. We have so many desires. Whether we think, generally we think that by my work, if I work hard and do this and do that, then I'll succeed and fulfill my desires. But no, ultimately, upadrashtano mantacha bhakta bhakta maheshwara, the maheshwara, or the supreme controller, and the anumanta, the permitter, is Krishna. He is the sanctioner. So no one can fulfill their desires unless Krishna sanctions it. So that one who has come by his own power, who is the one who fulfills the desires or doesn't fulfill the desires of all living entities, he has taken birth, he has assumed the body of Kapila Muni. Now what is he going to do? Brahma explains. By mystic yoga and the practical application of knowledge from the scriptures, Kapila Muni, who is characterized by his golden hair, his eyes just like lotus petals, and his lotus feet. This is some of his characteristics. He'll have golden hair, and his eyes are like the petals of a lotus. Very, very, very beautiful. Very wonderful shape. And his feet will be they bear the marks of the imprint, just like everyone has lines on their feet. Krishna's feet have specific markings, and he will have the marks of lotus flowers on his feet. So this Lord will come, and by teaching, his teachings of a combination of practical knowledge, gyan from Shastra, from the scriptures, practical knowledge, and mystic yoga, he's going to teach the living entities how to uproot the deep-rooted desire for materialistic work in this material world. Because this is the problem, that materialistic work means work or acting with me as the center, trying to enjoy as much as I can. So as long as we have this concept within our mind that things should be centered around me, and that I am the center, and that I should be enjoying, as long as we have that, We have to stay in the material world. So Kapila Muni's teachings will uproot that core concept in our heart that I am the center of existence. Basically, it means that we are envious of Krishna, because Krishna is the center of existence. So the symptom of that thinking ourself the center is the enjoyer of everything. The symptom of that, or rather how it is manifest practically in the material world, is the work becomes fruitive. We work to get something for me. So he's going to uproot that. His teachings will uproot that tendency. Prabhupada explains, everyone in this material world engages in achieving the fruits of his labor. A man tries to be happy by achieving the fruits of his own honest labor, but actually he becomes more and more entangled. Rather than becoming happy or satisfied, we become just more perplexed and entangled in more and more desire. One cannot get out of this entanglement unless he has perfect knowledge or devotional service. So this is what Kapila Muni is going to teach. Then after speaking to Kardama, telling him what he, thanking him, he basically said three things. He said, you have attained this, you have satisfied me by performing activities based on my order. And then he explained what he wanted, what he was suggesting be done with the daughters of Kardama Muni, and then he described his son Kapila Muni, what he would do. Then, after saying these things, he turned to Devahuti, his wife, Kardama's wife, and he said, my dear daughter of Manu, because her father was Swayambhuva Manu, that same Supreme Personality of Godhead who killed the demon Kaitava is now within your womb. He will cut off all the knots of your ignorance and doubts, then he will travel all over the world. Your son, because every woman wants a wonderful son. When she has a son, she wants him to be wonderful and famous and become a great doctor and solve the cure cancer or something like that, or become the prime minister or something like that, or become a wealthy business magnate or famous in some way or another, or a movie star or something like that. So your son will be the head of all the perfected souls. He will be approved by the acharyas, expert in disseminating real knowledge. The great teachers will accept his teachings. And amongst the people he will be celebrated by the name Kapila. As the son of Devahuti, he will be known as the son of Devahuti, your son. He will increase your fame. Then Brahma left, and he went back. He came with nine sages who were going to marry the nine girls, and he also came with the four Kumaras and Narada Muni who would not get married. So he left nine sages with Kardama Muni and took four away with him, the ones who were brahmacharis, who had taken the vow of celibacy. So Maitreya continues. After the departure of Brahma, Brahma then left. Kardama Muni, after Brahma left, having been ordered by Brahma, handed over his nine daughters, as instructed, to the nine great sages who created the population of the world. And then there's a list of who went with who was matched to who. Kala, his daughter Kala to Marichi, Anusuya to Atri, Shraddha to Angira, Haviabhu to Palasya, Ngati to Palaha, Kriya to Kratu, Kyati to Brigu, Arundhuti to Vashishta. So they're all, the sages and their wives are both very famous. He delivered Shanti to Atarva, and everyone was very happy. And then, thus married, the sages took leave of Kardama and departed full of joy, each for his own hermitage, over Dura. So then, that business was taken care of the first half. And then Kadama Muni, he turned to Kapila Muni, and he went to him in a very lonely place and began to speak to him, because he was his son. But yet not only was he his son, but he was also the Supreme Lord, because it's natural for a father to love his son. And it's natural for the living entity to love the Supreme Lord. So when the Supreme Lord is one's son, one's love is so great and so wonderful. So from text 27 to 34, the next eight texts, Kadama Muni will pray to Kapila Muni in a lonely place. Now, previously, if you remember, even from months ago, or from yesterday when we gave a recap of the story, we explained how when Swayambhuva Manu, Kadama Muni was basically a renunciant. He wasn't interested in materialistic life and really enjoying life to its fullest. Naturally, perhaps, he would not have gotten married. But to satisfy Brahma, he decided to get married. And to do that, he performed austerities and he saw the Lord. So as a result of that, Swayambhuva Manu came with Devahuti and said, "Here, please take my daughter and marry her." So Kadama Muni said, "Yes, I will marry her. But the one condition is that when we have children, as soon as I have a child, then I will leave. I will assume my natural position as a renunciant, a mendicant, wandering here and there. No possessions, no anxieties, fully dependent on Krishna." So Swayambhuva Manu said yes. But then when the children were born, the first children were born, they were all girls, and Devahuti said, "Who will take care of me? I need actually a son to instruct me before you leave," because Kadama Muni was about to leave, because this was the arrangement. So he said, "All right. But when that son is born," and he knew from Krishna's words previously that he would be the Lord, "when that son is born, then I will leave." So that son, Kapila Muni, was born, and he was ready to give up any connection, even though he was a great sage, he was ready to give up any connection with any type of material arrangements. So he went to Kapila Muni and offered some prayers. So there are eight prayers. We could divide them up. First, he speaks of his kindness. He's overjoyed that the Lord has come as his son. And he explains, "But this is just your kindness, because I'm your devotee. You have so kindly come to benedict me. Otherwise, no one can force God to come as your son. But this is Krishna's kindness when he wants to give some special benediction to his devotee. Just to help me out of your mercy, to increase my love for you, you have come as my son." So then he explains, then the second part he explains, so there's several verses where he explains that. Then he explains how he is not just a son, but yet he is also the Supreme Lord, and there's some characteristics of the Supreme Lord that are given, and even though he is his son, he surrenders to him. He explains how he's the source of everything. Even though he's his son, even though he has a form, he's yet the source of everything. Unlimited Lord. And then, in the final verse, he asks him for a benediction. Okay, so now we'll read those three parts. Actually, maybe we'll read the verses one after another so we can just get a feel for how they, for what he's saying. I'll read the first part. "Oh," Kadama Muni said, "after a long time, the demigods in this universe have become pleased with the suffering souls who are in material entanglement because of their own misdeeds. So everyone is suffering in this world. So how? So the pleasure of the demigods is that when they want to remove the suffering of the people of the world, this is how Kadama Muni is seeing it, they pray for the Lord to come as an incarnation. And when the Lord comes by His presence and His instructions, that everyone becomes joyful, because basically they can get out of the material world. And why do we suffer in the material world? Why? Because of things that we have done in the past and in the present life and in past lives. So no one should think, oh, I'm getting a bad deal, that I don't deserve this. Everyone must suffer in this world, and the real cause of the suffering is ourselves. Usually we blame others, but actually it's things that we've done in the past and in the present lives. So, regardless of how much we have to suffer in this life according to our karma, what we've done, when Krishna comes and we take shelter of that, the knot, the connection with the material world can be cut if we give ourselves to Krishna. So therefore Krishna's presence is mercy, because it can remove the suffering of the souls in this world who suffer according to their own deeds. After many, many births, mature yogis, by complete trance and yoga, endeavor in secluded places to see the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But, so it's so hard to see the Lord, to see you, and great, great renunciants go to the forest and live for thousands of years. Just with the hope, what feeds them is the hope that the Lord will come to them. And then, after so much endeavor, if Krishna desires, He will come to them. But then, Kadama Muni says, but yet, not considering the fact that we're just ordinary householders, you have come to our home as our son to support your devotees. You, my dear Lord, who are always increasing the honor of your devotees, have descended in my home just to fulfill your word and disseminate the process of real knowledge. Because he had told them this, you've come like this, you are so kind. Although you have no material form, you have innumerable forms. You have no material form, but that doesn't mean that you have no forms. You have innumerable forms. You have transcendental forms which are pleasing to your devotees. So he's explaining how Krishna, the nature of Krishna is that he is dealing with his devotees so specially. The yogis are meditating, and after so much hard work and austerity, maybe they'll see the Lord. And yet Krishna, when there's a devotee who loves him with his full heart, Krishna will come and become the son of that devotee. Kadama Muni, his words are meant to inflame the spark of desire that we have in our heart to become loving devotees of Krishna. Prabhupada explains in the purport to... we'll read some of the purports here. After many births, mature yogis, they're working so hard. So the first point is that Krishna comes to remove the suffering that we cause ourselves. And then the second point is the yogis have such a difficult time to reach the Lord, and sometimes they even think themselves God. And then Prabhupada explains in the purport to 29 how Krishna has come just to support his devotees. This is what Prabhupada says. Devotees are so affectionate towards the personality of Godhead that although he does not appear before those who practice yoga in a secluded place, even for many, many births, he agrees to appear in a householder's home where devotees engage in devotional service without material yoga practice. In other words, devotional service to the Lord is so easy that even a householder can see the Supreme Personality of Godhead as one of the members of his household, as his son, as Kadama Muni experienced. He was a householder, although a yogi, but he had the incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead as his son. So it was due to his householderness, his love, his devotion, that Krishna came. Devotional service is such a powerful transcendental method that it surpasses all other methods of transcendental realization. The Lord says, therefore, that he lives neither in Vaikuntha, in the spiritual world, nor in the heart of a yogi, but he lives where his pure devotees are always chanting and glorifying him. So what do we learn from that? What is the message from that? That we may not be very powerful yogis, great at concentrating our minds. We may not be renunciants. We may be attached to so many things. We may not have very much knowledge even. We may be busy in so many different things. But, if we can just always chant and glorify Him, Krishna, Krishna will live with such a devotee. When we want to know really how we should act, what should we do? The essence of all advice is to always think about Krishna, always chant Krishna's names and glorify Him. That is the essence of the Sankirtan movement that Mahaprabhu started and Prabhupada spread all over the world. To always be engaged somehow or another in remembering Krishna. Whether we are pure, whether we are impure, the same medicine is given. That medicine is to always, always chant Hare Krishna, especially congregationally together, because that makes a very deep impression in the heart. Always chant Hare Krishna, and thereby always remember Krishna. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is known as Bhakta Vatsal. He is never described as Jnani Vatsal, or one who has knowledge, or Yogi Vatsal. He is always described as Bhakta Vatsal, that means a lover of his devotees, because he is more inclined towards his devotees than towards other transcendentalists. In Bhagavad Gita, it is confirmed that only a devotee can understand him as he is. Bhaktyamam navijananti. One can understand me only by devotional service, Krishna says, not otherwise. Because by devotional service means serving Krishna, putting Krishna in the center of our lives, and acting to please Him. By that act, chanting, hearing, doing things for Krishna's pleasure, by that act, Krishna reveals Himself to His devotee by His own kindness and causes mercy. And then when Krishna reveals Himself, the more we understand Him, oh, the less we are attracted to the world of matter, the more we are attracted to Him, because that is Krishna. He is all attractive. He is all beautiful. He is everything that attracts one within the material world. He is concentrated sweetness. Satchidananda vigraha. Everything that is wonderful, truly wonderful, that is what Krishna is. And He possesses those qualities to an unlimited degree. So by hearing about Krishna, by glorifying Krishna, Krishna becomes pleased. That is devotional service. And by acting in devotional service, Krishna reveals more and more of who He is And then we become more attracted to him. And becoming more attracted to him, we want to serve him more. And by serving him more with more devotion, he becomes more pleased with us and reveals more to us of who he is. And as he reveals more to us who he is, we become still more attracted to him. And a wonderful transcendental cycle gains momentum. That understanding of Krishna, of who Krishna is and about him, alone is real. Because although jnanis, mental speculators, can realize only the effulgence or the bodily luster of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and yogis can realize only the partial representation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, a bhakta not only realizes him as he is, but also associates with the Personality of Godhead face to face. Just imagine. Associating being with that person who possesses all wonderful qualities, how our heart would be immediately taken up, and how, to put it in a trivial way, how happy we would be. But that's what happens with devotion. I think we'll stop here. Let's see if we can finish the chapter tomorrow. Any questions or comments?
You mentioned the cycle and gathering the nature.
The what?
A cycle and gathering the nature. So is that a fair analogy? Because I'm hearing
something about inertia.
Is momentum unrelated to inertia? Is there spiritual momentum?
Yeah, and there's also spiritual inertia too. We tend to have more spiritual inertia than spiritual momentum. Yeah? What is it? What is the law? An object at rest tends to stay at rest, and an object in motion tends to stay in motion. And you can feel that when, say, if you want to move something that's heavy, it's hard to get it started, right? It's almost like it's glued there. And then once it gets going, it's so much easier to move it. It has a certain mass, according to the mass, that is a certain inertia that's hard to overcome. So we suffer from spiritual inertia. But it's natural. The more we get attracted to Krishna, the more that we want to serve Krishna and give our hearts to him. Yes? And the more we do that, give our hearts to him, the more he reciprocates him, the more we understand, he reveals to us about him. And then the more we know him, we want to give our hearts to him more, the more we realize him, and continues. But it's breaking the inertia, the selfish inertia. It's very hard. The self-centeredness, very hard to break. And therefore, so strongly the instructions are given by Prabhupada in so many purports, that we have to break the self-centeredness. How? By serving the instructions of the spiritual master. That is the initial breaking. Bitter medicine. Any other questions or comments? Before you ask your question, you have to promise me it'll be an easy one. Okay? First you have to promise. Okay, who else? Any other questions? No, go ahead, I'm sorry. A simple one will take precedent, yes.
Have we got questions on this in the sheet of paper? I've lost track of the questions.
Yeah, we've lost track. I have them, but I...
Okay.
Do we have them?
Yeah.
Okay, we have them.
Which is the last few days?
But we're not. But I haven't. But these last two classes, I haven't been able to keep up with the schedule, as fate has it. Okay, now a very difficult question. Yeah. Easy question. Okay.
My Kardama Muni, despite having a certain law in his own home, he plans to leave that home.
Yeah, very good question. But this question is answered by Prabhupada in his purport later on. So we'll save it. And tomorrow, Krishnanath, we shall taste the sweetness of this question. If that's all right. Any other simple questions or hard questions? Or deep questions or whatever question, anything that's on anyone's mind?
You know, you say populating the universe.
Yep.
What do you mean by that? So all on the universe is a big place.
Yep. A lot of vacancies. It's a big place that needs to be filled up because it has a purpose. What is the purpose of the universe?
To exist.
Well, that's a better answer. I don't know. The purpose of the universe is to provide a facility for the souls who are, which means have turned their back on Krishna and want to be the center of existence. It's to provide them a facility to change their ways. So the comparison is given to the material universe is like a prison. So it's not that the government wants the prison, but as soon as there's a state, there's always a prison. There's no country in the world, no place, no situation in the past, in the present, or in the future where there won't be a prison. So the material world is a prison. And what's the purpose of the prison? That those lawbreakers who don't want to be with Krishna, want to be the center of things, can change their ways. So the populating the universe means filling it up with, providing the cells, more or less, the bodies, so that all the souls who have their own desires can be placed within specific bodies so that they can act out their karma and gradually make good choices and get out of the prison of the material world completely. Does that help? Really?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Because we usually don't think of the universe or the material world as purposeful until we understand that actually it has a purpose. There's nothing that doesn't have a purpose.
You know, I saw the universe as a big, vast galaxy, and then when you look at the stars in the sky at night...
Right, you turn out the lights and you look at the stars and you think, what's going on up there? And they're all different places where, although the scientists may discover it or they may not discover it, but they're all different places where souls are placed within specific bodies so that they can enjoy or suffer according to their karma. That's the universe, in brief. It's complicated. Yeah, so many. Makes you feel small.
I thought it was just like lots of galaxies in one universe.
And there's... Yeah, well, the universe isn't easy to understand, but it's my understanding, from what I understand from my study and hearing, is that we can't see beyond our one universe. So what we see is all situated with its unlimited planets up and down, north and south, whatever. They're unlimited planets all within this universe. And there are so many universes. This isn't the only universe. And this universe, although what are the scientists, they're saying that it's curved. I think they say it's curved, don't they? Something. But okay, so if it's curved, even though they can't quite take the next step, that means it has a boundary, right? So if there's a boundary, there's something external to it. And if there's something external to it, what is that something?
They can't see it.
They certainly can't see it, and no one else can either. But therefore we get transcendental descending knowledge to say, to take those next steps and say, yes, there is something beyond the universe, even though we can't see it. And what is that? More universes. And then there's unlimited universes, practically speaking, or uncountable numbers of universes, practically speaking. And that's one part of the entire existence. And there's so much more, a spiritual part that's eternal. Well, these material universes are temporary. They're always being created and destroyed. So the scientists say that there was a time of creation, and they say there's a time of destruction. But what was before that and what was after that, they can't say. And it's one thing that's so funny, to me it's funny anyway, they talk, according to the Bhagavatam, it describes that the source of the universe, I mean, it's very far out when you look at it from our point of view, but there's Lord Vishnu lies down, it was an expansion of Krishna, and from his navel comes a lotus, right? And what color is Krishna's, Lord Vishnu's skin? Do you know? Well, yeah, but like blackish, right? So what do the scientists say that the source of the universe is when they talk about it?
Yeah.
What do they say?
Blackish.
A blackish black hole. I think that's funny anyway. You think it's funny? A little bit. Okay, not very funny, but it's ironic anyway. Okay, so tomorrow, if Krishna allows, we shall meet again. And if Krishna allows, we'll finish the chapter 2. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Kardama Muni ki jai, Lord Kapil Dev ki jai, Lord Brahma ki jai, Gaura Bhakti Muni ki jai.